Friends, shall we gather our forces together, renewed by lunch and by a bit of rest? And the time we did not have in the morning to raise questions and interact, we'll have it in the afternoon. Among the speakers that we have now, after each person has made a presentation, we would have some time for interacting. And at the end of the entire round, many of the questions that came up in the morning presentations and we couldn't take up, we'll do them now. So right now we have Sunit, who is devoted to the study of integral psychology of Sri Aurobindo. And given the spiraling order leading up to a crescendo that we've had this morning pre-lunch, we now hope to have some insights, perspectives, born of a study of integral psychology on mutation, self-transformation, possibilities, processes, difficulties.
My talk will be in two parts. The first part, I'm looking at some problems, the need for reflection in terms of the state of affairs in psychology, in academic psychology around the world, and how a kind of a paradox which we find ourselves in, which I'll share with you shortly, and then how integral psychology shows us the way out. That's the second part. So I'll just begin with the first part. These were some ideas which got me thinking, inspired by an article which was written by a biophysicist by the name of Harold Marowitz. He'd written a number of books, commentaries on psychology and philosophy. Okay. Something peculiar has been going on in science for the past 100 years or more. Many researchers are unaware of it, and others won't admit it even to their own colleagues. But there is a strangeness in the air. What has happened is that biologists, who once postulated a privileged role for the human mind in nature's hierarchy, have been moving relentlessly towards the hardcore materialism that characterized 19th century physics. At the same time, physicists, faced with compelling experimental evidence, have been moving away from strictly mechanical models of the universe to a view that sees the mind as playing an integral role in all physical events. It is as if the two disciplines were on two fast-moving trains going in opposite directions and not noticing what is happening across the tracks. This role reversal by biologists and physicists has left the contemporary psychologist in an ambivalent position. From the perspective of biology, the psychologist studies phenomena that are far removed from the core of certainty, that is, the sub-microscopic world of atoms and molecules. From the perspective of physics, the psychologist deals with the mind, an undefined primitive that seems at once essential and impenetrable. Clearly, both views embody some measure of truth, and a resolution of the problem is essential to deepening and extending the foundations of behavioral science. The study of life at all levels, from the social to molecular behavior, has in modern times relied on reductionism as the chief explanatory concept. This approach to knowledge tries to comprehend one level of scientific phenomena in terms of concepts at a lower and presumably more fundamental level. In chemistry, large-scale reactions are accounted for by examining the behavior of molecules. Similarly, physiologists study the activity of living cells in terms of processes carried out by organelles and other subcellular activities. Even in geology, the formulations and properties of minerals are described using the feature of the constituent crystals. The essence of these cases is seeking explanation in underlying structures and activities. Reductionism at the psychological level is exemplified by the viewpoint in Carl Sagan's best-selling book, The Dragons of Eden. He writes, "My fundamental premise about the brain is that all its working, what we sometimes call mind, are a consequence of its anatomy and physiology and nothing more. As a further demonstration of this trend of thought, we note that Sagan's glossary does not contain the words mind, consciousness, perception, awareness, or thought, but rather deals with entries such as synapse, lobotomy, proteins, and electrodes. Such attempts to reduce human behavior to its biological basis has a long history, beginning with the early Darwinians and their contemporaries working in physiological psychology. Before the 19th century, the mind-body duality, which was central to Descartes' philosophy, has tended to place the human mind outside the domain of biology. Then, the stress that the evolutionists placed on our apeness made us subject to biological study by methods appropriate to non-human primates and by extension to other animals. The Pavlovian school reinforced that theme and it becomes a cornerstone of many behavioral studies in later psychology. While no general agreement has emerged among psychologists as to how far reductionism should be carried, most will readily concede that our actions have hormonal, neurological, and physiological components. Although Sagan's premise lies within a general tradition in psychology, it is radical in aiming at complete explanation in terms of the underlying level. This goal I take to be the thrust of his phrase, and nothing more. At the time, various schools of psychology were attempting to reduce their science to biology. Other life scientists were also looking for more basic levels of explanation. Their outlook can be seen in the writings of a popular spokesman of molecular biology, Francis Crick. In his book, Of Molecules and Men, A Contemporary Attack on Vitalism, the doctrine that biology needs to be explained in terms of life forces outside the domain of physics, Crick states, "The ultimate aim of the modern movement in biology is in fact to explain all biology in terms of physics and chemistry." He goes on to say that by physics and chemistry, he refers to the atomic level where one's knowledge is secure. By use of the italicized all, he expresses the position of radical reductionism that has been the dominant viewpoint among an entire generation of biochemists and molecular biologists. If we now combine psychological and biological reductionism and assume they are going to overlap, we end up with a sequence of explanation going from mind to anatomy and physiology, to cell physiology, to molecular biology, and then to atomic physics. All this knowledge is assumed to rest on a firm bedrock of understanding the laws of quantum physics, the newest and most complete theory of atomic structures and processes. Within this context, psychology becomes a branch of physics, a result that may cause some unease among both groups of professionals. Something that Vladimir was saying in the morning is not that if you, there's a lot of emphasis in academic psychology on quantification. And he said if you go on, then ultimately you're going to left with biology and then ultimately you'll move in this direction and come to physics in that case, if that's how we're going to be able to understand things. Now, this attempt to explain everything about human beings in terms of the first principles of physical science is not a new idea and had reached a definite position in the views of the mid-19th century European physiologists. A representative of that school, Emil Du Bois Reymond, excuse my pronunciation, set forth his extreme opinions in the introduction to an 1848 book on animal electricity. He wrote that if our methods only were sufficient, an analytical mechanics, read Newtonian physics, of general life processes would be possible and fundamentally would reach even to the problem of freedom of will. There is a certain hubris in the words of these early savants that was picked up by Thomas Huxley and his colleagues in their defense of Darwinism, and even today echoes in the theories of modern reduction. In the theories of modern reductionists who move from the mind to the first principles of atomic physics. It is most clearly seen at present in the writings of the sociobiologists whose arguments animate the contemporary intellectual scene. In any case, Du Bois Reymond's views are consistent with modern radical reductionists, except that quantum mechanics has now replaced Newtonian mechanics as the underlying discipline. During the period in which psychologists and biologists were steadily moving towards reducing their discipline to the physical sciences, They were largely unaware of perspectives emerging from physics that cast an entirely new light on their understanding. Towards the close of the 19th century, physics presented a very ordered picture of the world in which events unfolded in characteristic, regular ways, following Newton's equations in mechanics and Maxwell's in electricity. These processes moved inexorably, independent of the scientist who was simply a spectator. Many physicists considered their subject as essentially complete. Starting with the introduction of the theory of relativity by Albert Einstein in 1905, this neat picture was unceremoniously upset. The new theory postulated that observers in different systems moving with respect to each other would perceive the world differently. The observer thus became involved in establishing physical reality. The scientist was losing the spectator's role and becoming an active participant in the system under study. With the development of quantum mechanics, the role of the observer became an even more central part of physical theory, an essential component in defining an event. The mind of the observer emerged as a necessary element in the structure of the theory. The implications of the developing paradigm greatly surprised early quantum physicists and led them to study epistemology and philosophy of science. Never before in scientific history had all leading contributors produced books and papers expounding the philosophical and humanistic meanings of their results. Werner Heisenberg, one of the founders of new physics, became deeply involved in the issues of philosophy and humanism. In Philosophical Problems of Quantum Physics, he wrote of physicists having to renounce thoughts of an objective time scale common to all observers and events in time and space that are independent of our ability to observe them. Heisenberg stressed that the laws of nature are no longer dealt with. They are no longer dealing with elementary particles, but with our knowledge of these particles. That is, with the contents of our mind. Ernest Schrödinger, the man who formulated the fundamental equation of quantum mathematics, wrote an extraordinary little book in 1958 called Mind and Matter. In this series of essays, he moved from the results of the new physics to a rather mystical view of the universe that he identified with the perennial philosophy of Aldous Huxley. Schrödinger was the first of the quantum theoreticians to express sympathy with the Upanishads and Eastern philosophical thought. A growing body of literature now embodies this perspective, including the two very well-known works, Tao of Physics by Capra and Dancing Woolly Masters by Gary Zukav. The views of a large number of contemporary physical scientists are summed up in the essay Remarks on the Mind-Body Question, written by Nobel laureate Eugene Wigner. Wigner begins by pointing out that most physical scientists have returned to the recognition that thought, that is meaning the mind basically, or consciousness, thought or mind is primary. He goes on to state, it was not possible to formulate the laws of quantum physics in a fully consistent way without reference to consciousness. And he concludes by noting how remarkable it is that the scientific study of the world led to the content of consciousness as an ultimate reality, or as the ultimate reality. The founders of modern atomic theory did not start out to impose a mentalist picture on the world. Rather, they began with the opposite point of view and were forced to the present day position in order to explain experimental results. We are now in a position to integrate the perspectives of three large fields, psychology, biology, and physics. By combining the positions of Sagan, Crick, and Wigner as spokesmen for the various outlooks, we get a picture of the whole that is quite unexpected. First, the human mind, including consciousness and reflective thought, can be explained by activities of the central nervous system, which in turn can be reduced to the biological structure and function of that physiological system. Second, biological phenomena at all levels can be totally understood in terms of atomic physics. That is, through the action and interaction of the component atoms of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and so forth. Third and last, atomic physics, which is now understood most fully by means of quantum mechanics, must be formulated with the mind as a primitive component of the system. We have thus completed an epistemological circle from the mind back to the mind. The results of this chain of reasoning will probably lead more aid and comfort to Eastern mystics than to neurophysiologists and molecular biologists. Nevertheless, the closed loop follows from a straightforward combination of the explanatory processes of recognized experts in three separate sciences. Since individuals seldom work with more than one of these paradigms, the general problem has received little attention. And I'm still amazed that many of my colleagues and my senior colleagues, and back in 1994 when I came across some of these ideas, I passed on copies of the original writing by Harold Marowitz, where he had detailed these points. And I got no response. And I was, of course, wondering whether I've entered a dead-end discipline and whether I should be taking up neurobiology or something. And then, of course, Sri Aurobindo and the mother came to my rescue in 2001, 5 or 6 years after I had been reading this. So I'll jump now to Sri Aurobindo, because Sri Aurobindo begins with consciousness and how he defines psychology and what integral psychology is all about. Some of this you would have, of course, heard of, maybe all of it, some of you. So I ask for your patience. Now, Sri Aurobindo, in one of his writings, points out to three major errors of modern psychology. That is psychology which I have studied mostly in the university system and which most of us in the academia teach around the world. According to Sri Aurobindo, modern psychology makes three major initial errors which have hampered the study of human phenomena and the achievement of profounder knowledge. The first is the materialistic error, whereby psychologists identify the study of mind with the study of the body. The second error is the skeptical error, which according to him prevents any bold, I quote, any bold and clear-eyed investigation of the hidden profundities of our subjective existence. The error of conservative distrust and recoil, which regards any subjective state or experience that departs from the ordinary operations of our mental and psychical structure as a morbidity or a hallucination, just as in the Middle Ages, regarded all new science as magic and a diabolical departure from the sane and right limits of human capacity. All that is, the transcendental and which comes in the so-called spiritual domain. The third major error that psychology as a scientific discipline has made is the objective error, I quote, which leads the psychologist to study others from outside instead of seeing his true field of knowledge and laboratory of experiment in himself, by one's own consciousness has to be the starting point. Sri Aurobindo states, I quote, psychology is necessarily a subjective science and one must proceed in it from the knowledge of oneself to the knowledge of others. The surface personality, according to Sri Aurobindo, is only a small part of our being, which does not yield to us the root and secret of our character, mentality, or actions. Sri Aurobindo believes that to discover the deeper sources of our being and, I quote, to know the nature and the processes of the inconscient or subconscient self, and so far as is possible, to possess and utilize them as physical science possesses and utilizes the secret of the forces of nature, ought to be the aim of scientific psychology. End quote. Sri Aurobindo considered psychology as it was in the first half of the 21st century to be an infant science, which is rash and fumbling in its approach. With specific reference to psychoanalysis, he stated, and I think you, most of you would be very familiar with it, where he says, this new psychology looks to me very much like children learning some summary and not very adequate alphabet. Exulting in putting their A, B, C, D of the subconscient and the mysterious underground superego, referring to Freudian terms, together and imagining that the first book of obscure beginnings, C, A, T, cat, T, R, E, E, tree, is the very heart of the real knowledge. They look from down up and explain the higher heights by the lower obscurities. But the foundation of these things is above and not below. The superconscient, not the subconscient, is the true foundation of things. The significance of the lotus is not to be found by analyzing the secrets of the mud from which it grows here. Its secret is to be found in the heavenly archetype of the lotus that blooms forever in the light. The self-chosen field of this psychologist is, besides, poor, dark, and limited. You must know the whole before you can know the part, and the highest before you can truly understand the lowest. That is the promise of the greater psychology awaiting its hour, before which these poor groping will disappear and come to naught. With reference to the relationship of consciousness and personality, he states, I quote, "The gradations of consciousness are universal states, not dependent on the outlook of the subjective personality. Rather, the outlook of the subjective personality is determined by the grade of consciousness in which it is organized according to its typal nature and its evolutionary stage." Radical, but makes perfect sense. Regarding the scope of psychology, Sri Aurobindo believed that psychology cannot become a complete discipline if it is divorced from its metaphysical basis. In this context, he noted, "A complete psychology cannot be a pure natural science, but must be a compound of science and metaphysical inquiry." The rationale for this view is that since the wider functionings of consciousness are beyond the immediate perception of human mind, they can be known only through a metaphysical inquiry. According to Sri Aurobindo, all life is yoga, and the different academic disciplines and their approach towards knowledge is itself a part of a larger yoga. In this context, he states, "There are two kinds of knowledge." I quote, "There are two kinds of knowledge. That which seeks to understand the apparent phenomena of existence externally by an approach from the outside through the intellect. This is the lower knowledge, the knowledge of the apparent world. Secondly, the knowledge which seeks to know the truth of existence from within, in its source and reality, by spiritual realization. Ordinarily, a sharp distinction is drawn between the two, and it is supposed that when we get to the higher knowledge, the God knowledge, then the rest, the world knowledge, becomes of no concern to us. But in reality, there are two sides of one seeking. All knowledge is ultimately the knowledge of God. Through himself, through nature, through her works, mankind has first to seek this knowledge through the external life." Very important. "Mankind has first to seek this knowledge through the external life, for until its mentality is sufficiently developed, spiritual knowledge is not really possible. And in proportion as it is developed, the possibilities of spiritual knowledge become richer and fuller." End quote. Many academic disciplines, according to Sri Aurobindo, are seeking the lower knowledge, but they shall gradually move to the recognition of the higher knowledge. In the words of Sri Aurobindo, I quote, "Science, art, philosophy, ethics, psychology, the knowledge of man and his past action, the knowledge of man and his past action itself are means by which we arrive at the knowledge of the working of God through nature and through life. At first, it is the working of life and forms of nature which occupy us. But as we go deeper and deeper, we get a completer view and experience. Each of these lines bring us face to face with God." End quote. Sri Aurobindo outlines the further potential of some of the major academic disciplines, including psychology, as they may attempt to move from the lower to a higher knowledge. He states, I quote, "Science at its limits, even physical science, is compelled to perceive in the end the infinite, the universal, the spirit, the divine intelligence and will in the material universe. Still more easily must this be the end with psychic sciences, which deal with the operations of higher and subtler planes and powers of our being and come into contact with the beings and phenomena of the worlds behind, which are unseen, not sensible by our physical organs, but ascertainable by the subtle mind and senses. Art leads to the same end. Art leads to the same end. The aesthetic human being, intensely preoccupied with nature through aesthetic emotion, must in the end arrive at spiritual emotion and perceive not only the infinite life, but the infinite presence within her. Preoccupied with beauty in the life of man, he must in the end come to see the divine, the universal, the spiritual in humanity. Philosophy, dealing with the principles of things, must come to perceive the principle, capital P. Philosophy must come to perceive the principle of all these principles, and investigates its nature, attributes, and essential workings. So ethics must eventually perceives that the law of good, which it seeks, is the law of God and depends on the being and nature of the master of the law. And in the end, in this quote, he says, "Psychology leads from the study of the mind and the soul in living beings to the perception of the one soul and one mind in all things and all beings." The discipline of psychology has viewed human growth and development as a process of change. A change that is, this is again coming back to academic psychology, a change that is not necessarily progressive and can comprise of both positive and negative changes. For instance, the cognitive capacities of an individual during a lifetime can increase and expand during childhood, reach their optimal level of functioning in adulthood, and may also decline in old age. This is a conventional academic view. According to Sri Aurobindo, this is a narrow perspective of viewing human growth and development, as it brings in focus only a small part of our surface personality. A study of Sri Aurobindo's perspectives on philosophy and psychology widens the lens of human growth and development immensely, where the process of human development is viewed as being essentially progressive in nature. From the perspective of Sri Aurobindo, the developmental process and potential of human beings can be understood only if we understand human development not only in the context of a single life course, but from the widest perspective of man's relation to the cosmos and the present lifetime only as a part of the journey of the soul. To use the metaphor of a tree, it seems to me that psychology as an academic discipline has limited itself to understanding the nature of the trunk, the leaves, flowers, and fruits of a tree without really bothering to have a coherent theory about the seed from which the tree emerges, nor the sun from which it draws nourishment and towards which it grows. Psychologists relegate the issues of the origins of the cosmos, its goal, purpose, and sustenance to the metaphysical realm, as they cannot be investigated through the myopic empirical vision. All theoretical perspectives, however, are necessarily rooted in hidden assumptions about the nature of the cosmos and reality, and it would be a more fruitful exercise to clearly articulate these assumptions to facilitate and broaden the understanding of human phenomena. Sri Aurobindo's approach is based on the twin concepts, as most of you know, on the twin concepts of involution and evolution that characterize the cosmic reality. The ultimate superconscient divine reality expressed as Satchit Anand through a process of involution plunges into its opposite, the inconscient. Evolution, according to Sri Aurobindo, is a process through which the supreme consciousness liberates itself from the inconscience to progressively manifest at higher levels and gradations. This forms the widest lens within which human growth and progress can be viewed with reference to the original cause of development, its purpose, nature, its directionality, and levels of its successive expressions. And as I come towards the last part, in addition to the broad evolutionary perspective related to cosmic evolution, Sri Aurobindo's works also provide an insight into the sociological and individual psychological, what they call social psychology in academia, in the academia, dimensions of human evolution. His work throws light on the relation between the individual and collective evolution from a spiritual-historical perspective and provides a commentary on the state of contemporary humanity. The conscious collaboration between the human and the divine through yoga is a key idea through which the human beings can take a step forward in evolution, mutation. Sri Aurobindo and the mother's works contain the details of the psychological preparation that needs to be done to be able to become a conscious participant in the process of evolution and become capable of exploring new developmental possibilities from the highest consciousness that they are capable of manifesting. The aim in Sri Aurobindo's words is, I quote, "By this yoga, we not only seek the infinite, but we call upon the infinite to unfold himself in human life." One may ask, what is the current impasse that humanity as a whole feels today
And what knowledge do we need to take the next step as humanity? Have we as humankind been able to explore and also see the limits of rationality? Do we feel a need within for a higher consciousness that is able to rein in the divisive force of the human ego that draws sustenance from a kind of rationality that divides but is not capable of accessing experientially oneness and integrity, our current consciousness? What do we aspire towards as humanity? If our need is to move towards what the seers have experienced for humanity at large, for it is that consciousness alone that can pull us out of our individual and collective egos and grow into a consciousness that has harmony as its key note, then psychology as a discipline of inquiry cannot remain unresponsive to that evolutionary need, if that is our goal, which I personally consider the most important goal of psychology also. I assert that if psychology does not respond to the need of humanity in terms of fundamentally reconsidering its scope and purpose, it will become a field redundant for humanity that will grow and progress despite it. They will not have much use and need for psychology, and not because of it. To sum up, in the words of Sri Aurobindo, God shall grow up while the wise men talk and sleep. Sri Aurobindo, as a yogi, not only saw the current psychological impasse of humanity suffering from an essentially ego-based consciousness, but also did his yoga to be able to create conditions whereby a higher stage of consciousness in the form of the supramental becomes the basis of a new psychology and manifests itself not only in a select few, but gradually and potentially becomes available to humanity as a whole. And so I end with this little piece. The journey of human evolution becomes an exploration of a new path. It is a journey within, a path which has its aim, the discovery of the truth within. In other words, it is a discovery, or rather a creation, of the new values and life goals in a play with the inner divine. Sri Aurobindo in Savitri calls it the house of spirit, a new creation. The result of the play is a new creation of the self and a new basis of relating to the other through the loss of the external ego and reclaiming of the true divine person within. The play of the human and the divine is thus expressed in Savitri. On a meeting line of hazardous extremes, the game of games was played to its breaking point, where through self-finding by divine self-loss, there leaps out unity's supreme delight, whose blissful undivided sweetness feels a communality of the absolute. There was no sob of suffering anywhere. Experience ran from point to point of joy. Bliss was the pure, undying truth of things. All nature was a conscious front of God. This then is the goal of the new agenda of psychology, to explore the alchemy of the transmutation of the human into the divine. According to Sri Aurobindo, the two apparently contradictory realities can affect this mutual transmutation because they are in essence one. Integral psychology thus opens out this new dimension of human development and progress and lays bare the dynamics of transformation of consciousness leading to a decisive reversal of consciousness from a life in ignorance to a life divine. Thank you.
In
very general terms, it refers to levels of consciousness or levels of awareness beyond this level of mind, rational mind. And it would refer to all the higher stages beyond that. Sri Aurobindo has given several stages above that. Vijnanamaya in the Upanishadic concept, yeah. Like they speak of the anamaya kosha, the bodily conscious, the pranamaya, and the Manomaya, and then Vijnanamaya is that. And here Aurobindo specifically referred to that as the supramental. Yeah.
Is it going to be possible for you to send us by electronic mail copies of the papers?
Pardon?
I would like to read this for myself.
Yes.
Through electronic mail, perhaps?
Right, right. I'll do that. I'll do that.
Yes.
No, I was saying I would also like to have this by electronic mail. Yes. You want me to repeat one morning question? But not to
him. Okay. Yeah.
No, in fact, Sunit, you will give us the paper and then we can pass it on to you. But all of those who have written papers, like Prema and Binu, we'll be glad to have them all. Because we'd like to circulate them, put them. Attach them up. But I must say that, Sunit, you have very beautifully brought out how psychology moves into a totally new domain. It is the path to transformation. Psychology as yoga. That be talking of mutation, so far we have not talked of the process. Perhaps this is the first in our series of today where we are touching the process. What the process means, and Vladimir over lunch was talking a great deal about the psychological approach to it. So here it is the process, which is, as Shabindu, you say somewhere, yoga is nothing but practical psychology. Thanks, Sunit, and you'll touch it up and give it to us. Thank you.